Well, welcome everybody. I'm really, as I was just saying to Daniel, although I'm Mary Caldor and I'm Professor of Global Governance here, but I've been a long time peace activist. In fact, I joined Youth CND when I was 14, I think, and went on my first Aldermaston March at 12. And then in the 80s, I was really involved in European nuclear disarmament. And so I'm really pleased that we have this opportunity. It's 50 years since CND was 60. 60, it was 57, wasn't it? 58. But this great meeting with Canon Collins and Bertrand Russell, wasn't that?
February the 17th, 1958.
Okay, so it was 58 anyway, because my mum took my two older sisters to that. Anyway, so it's really nice that we've got Kate Hudson, who was the chair of CND and who's written a book about the history of CND, to come and introduce her book. And the book is for sale outside, if any of you want to buy it, which I hope you will after hearing Kate. So I'll hand over to Kate.
Thanks. Thanks very much indeed, Mary, and thanks to everybody for coming along. I'm going to start by saying a little bit about the current context in which we're working and operating, the age of Trump, as some people call it. Then I'm going to take a kind of quick look at the history of CND and its relevance today, and then conclude by talking a little bit about the not just the challenges that we face, but what we've got on our side, so to speak. So, starting off, whoops, not doing that. There we are. So, one of the most iconic images of the 20th century. That is one of the many, many nuclear weapons tests which took place in the late 50s and early 1960s. You think about the mushroom cloud above Hiroshima, it was just a tiny fraction of the size of that enormous test. Some of the tests were over 1,000 times the size of the bomb which was dropped on Hiroshima or indeed Nagasaki. So this image has been an image of terror throughout the 20th century, and of course it's increasingly coming to the public consciousness in the 21st century as well. And I think over the last few months, obviously the media likes to, you know, spin a good story and so on, but they've been actually been talking about the possibility of World War III over the last 6 months, you know, around Trump, North Korea, and so on. And I think that although, yes, they like their rhetoric and escalatory talk, but those very real dangers are indeed with us. So, what do we know about the dangers that we currently face? Well, every year, the Bulletin of Economic Scientists, which is US economic scientists, they produce, they have a thing called the Doomsday Clock, and every year they do an assessment of how many minutes to midnight the clock is. And this year, they moved it to 2 minutes to midnight. It's never been closer than that, and it was 2 minutes to midnight in 1953. So their assessment is that we are at an extremely dangerous moment in world history. And although they talk about climate change and other things like cyber warfare and so on, in their analysis, they put nuclear really front and center of their assessment. And they talked about three particular things. They talked about reckless language being used at senior levels, and this is Mr. Trump, who's a master of reckless language. This is him saying that he's pulling out of the Iranian nuclear deal. So he tore up, eagerly tore up, one of the best guarantees of no nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, you know, which have brought Iran to the negotiating table and removed the danger of an Iranian nuclear weapons program. He tore that up. That seems pretty reckless to me. And of course, We've also had reckless language around North Korea. He threatened to totally destroy it. And then, of course, he's now, well, then he went into having a great dialogue and arrangement with North Korea that they would denuclearize. Then he trashed that. And now he's trying getting back that back on track. You know, so this kind of swings, you know, roller coaster of rhetoric and so on from the US president. But they also talked about other dangers, nuclear dangers as well. They talked about the danger of new nuclear weapons and massive spending on new nuclear weapons programs. And in fact, this is most clearly outlined in the document produced earlier on this year by the Trump administration, the new nuclear posture review. And not only did they commit to spending over $1 trillion on modernizing their nuclear weapons program, this review introduces a commitment to producing usable nuclear weapons, so-called, by which they mean what they describe as low-yield nuclear weapons. We've heard this jargon before, I think, in the early 1990s. But what do they mean by low-yield? Well, in today's parlance, the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs would be described as low-yield. So we're not talking about something small here. The posture review also talks about more scenarios in which nuclear weapons would be used, or could be used. So it both brings usability into the narrative, and it also increases the range of options where one could use them. So it's a very, very, very dangerous document indeed. And then it also talks about, this is still talking about the Bulletin of Atomic Sciences, scientists, they also talk about provocative military exercises. And I think it's worth noting another document which was produced around about the same time as the Posture Review, and that is the US Strategic Defense Review. And that's a very interesting thing because you'll be aware that over the last decade, the US has had what Obama called the pivot to Asia, where they were kind of orientating around China because of the rise of China as a global power, particularly as an economic power, challenging the US. This new Strategic Defense Review also includes Russia very prominently in the Defense Review. So they've pulled back from the War on Terror narrative and are now going on the kind of anti-Russia and anti-China sort of approach instead. And they use the terminology in the review, suggesting that, I think they call them revisionist powers. Russia and China are revisionist powers who wish to remodel, reshape the world in the image of their authoritarian regimes. So this is a kind of new, personally, I think it's a kind of an ideological window dressing when really they're just concerned about markets and resources and so on. But that's the orientation. So I think it's a very, very dangerous document. And it signals a shift from the kind of asymmetric warfare of the War on Terror phase, where it's not state on state action, towards the kind of Cold War state on state global actors framework instead. And of course, if you've got that state on state thing, you're also then opening the door to nuclear war, because if you're talking about conflict between the US and Russia or China, or Russia and China, then you do very much open that door. And you can see from this little map here some of the kind of flashpoints around the kind of China, Eastern Russia, sort of eastern part of the Eurasian landmass. So quite a build-up there. So the atomic scientists, they talk about provocative military exercises, which are partly to do with the developments around here. You may remember, with reference to the Korean Peninsula, the concerns about US and allied troop manoeuvres in South Korea and the kind of problems that was creating with the dialogue between South and North Korea. But then also still predominantly in the West, but kind of globalising much more, you've got NATO as well. NATO expansion, of course. We can see this is a somewhat out-of-date map, so I apologise for that, because since the since this map was produced, Croatia and Albania have also become part of NATO. Montenegro has joined, that was the most recent member, joined this month a year ago, and Macedonia and Bosnia-Herzegovina are next in line. Of course, Ukraine and Georgia are not in NATO. You know, that is the red line which Russia has drawn. It will not accept those countries going into NATO in their kind of soft underbelly, as it were. So you can see that. And then, of course, the military exercises, which you'll have heard quite a lot about, I imagine. NATO conducted over 100 exercises, military exercises, in 2017 alone. Britain has been involved in a lot of them. Some of them kind of fly off Scotland and so on, do the kind of air exercises up there. So Britain is also very involved in all this, contributing to Russia, tension with Russia and China. So this is what I think we all need to be very worried about. You can see that is the so-called nuclear football that President Trump is carrying. That's the codes, the bag with the codes for launching a nuclear attack, which is always in very close proximity to the president, wherever he goes. So, a matter of great concern. So that's a very sort of quick roundup of the kind of threats that we face. This, of course, is, well, 1945, by today's capacities, this would be magnified 100, if not 1,000-fold, in the event of use of nuclear weapons. It was this kind of catastrophe and the uniqueness of nuclear weapons, the unique terror of them because of the radiological consequences, that led to the foundation of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in 1958. And this is a picture from the first Aldermaston March. Aldermaston is the atomic weapons establishment in Berkshire where nuclear warheads are still made. There's our warheads are still made there. They were being researched and developed and made in 1958. And there was an enormous public outcry in the late 50s about nuclear weapons. Interestingly, not so much about the danger of their use, although that was a concern, but a real anxiety and anger about the weapons testing, the nuclear weapons testing that was taking place at that time. So around about this time, by the late 50s, early 60s, over 300 nuclear explosions had taken place in the atmosphere, and as I said, some 1,000 times the size of the Hiroshima bomb. And scientific evidence was showing peaks in cancers, you know, cancer clusters and spikes in cancers around the proximity and the timing of these weapons tests. And there was huge public concern. And a lot of the groups which were the forerunners of CND were actually groups set up by women, particularly mothers, who were concerned about the impact on their children, and there was evidence that strontium-90, a kind of byproduct of the testing, was getting into milk products and therefore would be a danger to their children. So it was this kind of massive upsurge, which also very much tied into the radicalization of the time. You know, this was the late 50s, there was a generation had come through after the Second World War with access to free education. So there was this kind of youth culture, not for the first time, I'm sure, but a new type of youth culture. And on these demonstrations, these big marches that went to Aldermaston, there were jazz bands and beatniks, and every different kind of subcultural development that you could imagine. They were really radical developments. And they went on for a number of years. They went on the first wave from 1958 to 1963. This is the send-off in Trafalgar Square for the first march. We know that it's the first march because the first one was from London to Aldermaston. After that, they changed and they were from Aldermaston to London. But you can see there the slogan on there, from fear to sanity. You know, no missile bases here. But really, that was the sentiment of the time. I think what really strikes me is how everyone in those days seemed to wear hats. Very noticeable. That's another picture of it. Against H-bombs. And then this is a kind of parallel and related development to the development of CND. This was a thing called the Committee of 100. Any philosophers amongst you might notice that the gentleman in the middle with the hat, that we're walking with the woman with the fur coat, that's Bertrand Russell and his wife Lady Russell. Bertrand Russell was the first president of CND, very, very powerfully anti-nuclear weapons, and because, of course, he was one of the greatest philosophers of the age, that had a huge pull on people. You know, people were very compelled by that. And after a couple of years of CND going on big demos, he was a bit tired of this. He said, you've got to do something different, you know, you're not making a difference. We can't just do safe things. We've got to challenge the government more effectively. And he started this thing called the Committee of 100, which focused on civil disobedience. You know, I think he was kind of influenced by Gandhi, perhaps, you know, the huge civil disobedience campaigns in the struggle for Indian independence. So he got the Committee of 100 were kind of famous people who committed to civil disobedience in the form of things like sitting down in Whitehall, for example. So thousands of people would sit down in Whitehall and block traffic and try and obstruct government in that way, and did this at various places around the country. Sadly, that didn't change government policy either. And so the Committee of 100 kind of petered out after a bit. But CND went on to embrace all these different forms of protest. So everything non-violent, you know, whether it's demonstrations or petitioning or writing a letter or going to see your MP or lying down in the road or trying to block a base, you know, CND embraced all those diverse forms of protest. I mentioned cultural stuff. That's a massive puppet from the time. There was a kind of craze for huge puppets on a lot of these demonstrations, particularly on the anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, and big quotes and so on. Okay, so I'll fill in, that's the 80s, and I'll just fill in a little bit between then. So in 1963, after this massive wave of big demonstrations and protests and all that kind of thing, the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, and the world almost went to the brink. You know, people thought that, you know, they didn't know if they'd be getting up again the next morning, genuinely. But that didn't, you know, they did pull back from the brink, and what happened as a result of that was two things. One, there was a kind of, the red phone line was established between Moscow and Washington to kind of try and head off the dangers of, you know, nuclear weapons being used, so to establish that line of dialogue. But the other really key thing was that the powers agreed to have a ban on testing weapons in the atmosphere. So the partial test ban treaty was introduced, and nuclear weapons testing had to be done underground. So that was a massive victory. And the kind of, so that first surge, that huge wave of protest kind of ebbed away slightly. And so the late 60s and into the 1970s, CND didn't have the prominence that it had had before. But it was very active on two fronts. One was against the introduction of Polaris submarines and missiles into Scotland. That was, we decided to lease US nuclear missiles instead of making our own at great expense. So they came to Scotland, so a big protest against that. And of course the Vietnam War, came along, you know, in the 1960s. So although CND was an anti-nuclear organisation, overwhelmingly people also wanted to oppose the war on Vietnam, not surprisingly on many levels, but also additionally because Nixon did think of using, he did talk about whether he should use nuclear weapons on Vietnam, you know, and was deterred because of the scale of the protests against nuclear weapons and against the war. You know, so there were still a lot of things going on. But then the next big wave of CND was the 1980s, and this is where some of us in this room, I think, became active. Mary did, was very active in the 1980s. Oh, really? Oh, good for you.
And embarrassingly, I got sent home in a taxi by the police because I was underage.
Good for you.
But 80s, you're right.
Yeah. So the 80s, I mean, so many people I meet now say, oh, I went on my first demonstration in the 80s. My first political involvement was Youth CND. And from a kind of relatively small membership in the late 1970s, in fact, somebody rather rudely described it as the shoebox years, because you could fit all the membership cards in one shoebox. It then kind of escalated massively, huge proliferation of sort of spontaneous groups being set up, just as so-and-so street against cruise missiles, because the US wanted to bring cruise missiles, as they were called, to Britain and Polaris missiles to Europe. And what this meant was that if the US and the Soviet Union went to war, they would fight it out in Europe. They were kind of intermediate range nuclear missiles, and they could have their nuclear war in Europe. So they didn't have to kind of, you know, suffer that kind of damage and loss themselves. And pretty much everybody at the time knew exactly what it meant. So therefore, people were out protesting because they feared for their lives. You know, this was a very real existential thing. And I think everyone who was around at that time would have felt terrified, basically. You know, there are a lot of very good films from that time which really convey that. Things like Threads and When the Wind Blows and so on, that kind of real terror that we felt. And it meant that 500,000 people joined CND, you know, hundreds and hundreds of local groups and so on, and huge demonstrations. This is one of the ones in Hyde Park, I think. But it was also the time, of course, of peace camps too. People were so creative in the way in which they demonstrated. This is Greenham, of course. This is the day when I think it was 32,000 women went to Greenham and held hands around the base. It's a massive, many miles long perimeter fence, and we were able to ring the fence. But there were there were mixed camps as well at Molesworth and Upper Hayford and many other places around the country. It was a massive debate, public debate. That's more at Greenham. And then, in fact, subsequently, well, the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp stayed on for about 15 or almost 20 years, I think, until the cruise missiles had been removed, which they were in the 1990s, but until the base had been removed as well, and it was returned to common land. So they were extraordinarily determined and ultimately successful. Some pictures of the demos themselves. Protest and Survive. Yes, that was one of the big slogans from the 1980s on the banner, big central banner. The broken missile symbol was designed for CND by Peter Kennard, who's a very well-known, still very famous political artist. But Protest and Survive, that term arose because the government at that time produced a booklet called Protect and Survive, which it distributed to every household in the country. It included such fantastic advice as whitewash your windows, get under the dining table, you know, the completely crazy things. And the position of CND was that you can't survive a nuclear holocaust. There's no point in, it's wrong and immoral to try to make, give people the hope that that's possible. The only way to survive is to protest and bring about the end of nuclear weapons. So with the kind of the political and campaigning resurgence going on, we also got a bit of a resurgence around the cultural sphere as well. We got enormous support from artists, writers, musicians, everything, including pop musicians. This is one of the early Glastonbury festivals, which was in its origins the CND Glastonbury Festival. See the sign there. And of course we still have a presence at Glastonbury Festival, looking a bit hippie-ish there. But it goes down very well. And then, yeah, an example of a, some of the, if any of you remember Madness, the band at the time. They were very strongly anti-nuclear weapons, as are many musicians. So, of course, CND hasn't ever just confined its work to protest of that sort, you know, public protest, demonstrations and all that sort of thing, vigils, camps. We've also been very active in the parliamentary sphere as well. This is doing a bit of decorating of Parliament Square. I don't remember exactly when that was. But we are very active in Parliament. We have a currently have a parliamentary CND group, which is MPs, obviously, who support our goals. The current chair of it is Caroline Lucas, the Green MP. Her predecessor was Jeremy Corbyn MP before he was leader of the Labour Party. But it's a cross-party group and does a considerable amount of work trying to raise the issues with government. So coming now into the 21st century, our work in the 21st century has been dominated really by two key developments. One is the attempt by our government, which unfortunately has currently been successful, to replace the Trident nuclear weapon system. That's our submarine-based nuclear weapon system, to replace it with a whole new submarine system with upgraded missiles, warheads, and so on. So the greatest struggle, I suppose, that we've had since the turn of the millennium has been to attempt to win the debate politically in the country and in Parliament against the replacement of nuclear weapons. And I think it's probably true to say that we failed to win it in Parliament, but polls suggest that we have won it or have a majority in terms of across the country amongst civil society and the population at large. And primarily the reason for that is because it's not seen, nuclear weapons aren't seen to meet the security challenges which we currently face. It seemed to be a phenomenally expensive white elephant. And in fact, the cost of replacing Trident is in the region of £205 billion, including its lifetime costs, and that is likely to rise substantially. So it's an enormous amount of expenditure. And in fact, that is one of the reasons why we now have unexpected allies, perhaps, that we wouldn't have necessarily had in the past, that's to say, from senior military figures who say that Trident is militarily useless and it should be scrapped. They would rather the money was spent on ships, helicopters, cyber warfare, boots for the troops, proper housing, you know, anything useful that you could use, actually use in the defence of the country or in the maintenance of our armed forces. And in fact, this was rather borne out by a senior NATO official who said that Britain can either be a nuclear-armed state or it can be a useful military ally. We can't afford to do both. So that kind of argumentation, as well as the opportunity cost of spending on Trident in terms of social spending, that has been a big factor as well. In fact, since the financial crisis of 2008, it's really given impetus to the economic arguments against Trident. You know, people would rather the money was spent on the National Health Service or investment in industry or infrastructure, education, and so on. That's handing in some petition there. Oh, this is for your entertainment. We have a Christian C&D section. This is a bishop at, I think that's at Faz Lane base in Scotland. He's exorcising the base because of the nuclear weapons, the evil nuclear weapons that are there. But we do have a very strong support in the faith community as well as across all other communities too. Not just Christian denominations, but Muslim denominations, Sikh, all different kinds of religious faiths are active against nuclear weapons. And of course, the support for getting rid of Trident is something that is shared across society too. So one of the ways in which we try to work and organise is by building alliances across society. We're not the kind of organisation which is everything has to be CND alone. You know, everyone has to join CND or nothing. You know, that's not the approach we take. We take the approach that we want to work with others. We can all get behind the same goal. You know, we want to work in alliance and so on. And we were very delighted that having worked with some of the Muslim organisations during the anti-Iraq war campaigns, a lot of their young people, including these young women here, also got involved with the No Trident Replacement campaign. And of course the Iraq war, the war on Iraq, which was sort of in the offing since 2001 and the beginning of the war on terror, CND decided that it would get involved in the anti-war movement, and in fact we were part of the organising of the massive march in February 2003. That was organised by the Stop the War Coalition, CND, and the Muslim Association of Britain. So it's a kind of very broad social and political alliance against the war on Iraq. And of course, one or two people in CND said, why are you getting involved in that? It's not about nuclear weapons. Well, A, everyone wanted to get involved in it anyway because it was a massive and terribly dangerous thing. But also it was very much about nuclear weapons because it was about weapons of mass destruction, you know, the lies about weapons of mass destruction, the dodgy dossier and so on. And in fact, some of our more enterprising members would go out dressed as weapons inspectors to places like Aldermaston and Faz Lane and with big pointy fingers saying, the nuclear weapons are here, we found them, they're not in Iraq. You know, trying to highlight the double standards, really, that exist around these issues. So a bit of a resurgence of student CND around the anti-war campaigning. We had a bit of a membership surge. And then we had a big, so then the vote against Trident replacement was coming up in Parliament in 2006. So we had a big demonstration at that time, showing the alliance there in the middle. The Bishop of Reading, as he was then, whose diocese covers Aldermaston, he was very actively against nuclear weapons. And the man to his right is John Trickett MP, who at that time was a kind of backbench Labour MP. Now he's in the shadow cabinet. So that was massive, very successful demonstration. We twinned it with the troops out of Iraq slogan. That was early 2006. It had about 100,000 people on it. Yes, a very popular issue. And then on the vote day, this was in the vote day in 2006, when the government called its first parliamentary vote on whether it should sort of go ahead with the first stages of Trident replacement. At that time, the price tag was £76 billion. Now it's £205 billion, but at that time it was £76 billion. So a few famous people there. Bianca Jagger in the middle, who's a great anti-nuclear campaigner. Annie Lennox, Vivian Westwood. That's Joan Ruddock, who was a former chair of CND, and of course Jeremy Corbyn, at that time a vice chair of CND. And then we engaged in a range of different activities. I was saying we do different types of campaigning. So on the day, this was the vote day, we decided to try and block trans traffic in Parliament Square. So these people are locked together inside these bins, which have been had cement put into them. So it takes a very, very long time for the police to get you out. So I think they blocked the square for several hours to raise public awareness and protest about the replacement of Trident. Of course, quite a big thing in the student movement as well at that time. Student CND, this was at an NUS conference where the NUS conference passed a motion against the replacement of Trident. And we also, as well as doing that sort of thing, we also have a campaign against missile defence, which you may be aware of. It's one of the key things that causes tension with Russia and China. It's a kind of variant of President Reagan's Star Wars initiative that he had in the early 1980s, where basically you shoot down incoming missiles. You have kind of great big, I don't know exactly the technology, but anyway, great big shields, radar shields and virtual shields, and then they shoot down incoming missiles, which means essentially that it's called a defensive thing. What it really means is that you can attack another country without fear of retaliation. You know, the whole kind of balance between the US and Russia was always supposed to be mutual assured destruction. You know, if you fire at us, we're far back, everyone will be destroyed, so no one's going to do it. But in actual fact, the missile defense system stops that happening. It means the US could attack without fear of retaliation. So we were involved in a big campaign in Eastern Europe. This guy here, or these, both of these people are from the Czech Republic, and they had a massive campaign to prevent the United States putting a radar for the missile defense system just out in a tiny village just outside Prague. And this guy here was the mayor of that village, which had about 100 people in it. And he held a referendum in the village about whether or not the radar should be situated there. And it was like 99% against, if not 100, not surprisingly. And then they had a mayor's movement, and all the mayors in the region all held these referenda, which were all against the sighting of the thing. And eventually they had to, you know, give up and go home, and they never had it there. So it was a very, very successful campaign. So we try and support international stuff. That's an international conference we had on our 50th birthday. Doesn't time fly? And on our 50th birthday, we also had a big event at Aldermaston. I've shown you this because there's an example of some creative sign adjusting, where WMD has been inserted over whatever was under there. So that's rather nice. And then this was actually on that day as well. I've shown you this because this is the family of Gerald Holton, who was the designer who designed the famous CND symbol in 1958. It's obviously, it's incredibly well known now, generally more thought of as the peace symbol, but it actually, it's the semaphore signs for N and D, nuclear disarmament. So anyway, it's gone on to be, you know, massively iconic symbol. So that was rather nice, meeting up with them. And then, so we are where we are now. This seems to be escalating very rapidly through this, without me touching it. Anyway, so those were climate change. This is cyber warfare. This is someone putting their finger on the button. I don't know why, Daniel, it's whizzing through these without me touching them.
Sorry.
I mean, I'm almost at the end anyway, so maybe it doesn't really matter.
Let's see if there's something that's happening to it. Yeah, I think it just sat off an animation. That just, there you go.
Okay.
Should just
Thanks.
Work with the thing.
Okay. So, well, never mind. Climate change, quickly. One of the greatest threats that we face today. You know, that's the kind of thing that the global community needs to be working together to deal with. Cyber attack and cyber warfare, another massive global challenge which countries need to come together to resolve. And they shouldn't be thinking about pressing the nuclear button. In particular, our Prime Minister shouldn't be saying, yes, of course I'd press the button and kill thousands of people. This is an example of, this is our demonstration, Stop Trident demonstration, 2 years ago, just a few months before Parliament voted to replace Trident. But on that demonstration, we had tens of thousands of people. We had the First Minister of Scotland, we had the Leader of the Opposition, the Leader of the Green Party, Plaid Cymru, trade union leaders.
Go back.
Well, maybe if I go back and hold. Okay, so yeah, so there's Nicola Sturgeon and Caroline Lucas and, oh dear, it's got a mind of its own. Anyway, and a return to the puppets of the past. Anyway, no, don't worry, so
sure.
I'll just talk very quickly. So, this is really an example of the kind of broad alliances that we attempt to work with and the kind of mobilisation that we've been able to achieve against Trident. Unfortunately, as I say, one of the first things that Theresa May did when she came into government was charge into the vote on Trident, which Cameron had kept on delaying. Not sure that he was really that keen on going ahead with it. But she charged ahead with that, drove it through Parliament. Labour was in disarray because, although, of course, Jeremy Corbyn is anti-Trident, the Labour Party still has pro-nuclear policy. So that's where we are now, although, of course, we continue the struggle to cancel the replacement of Trident. It's interesting to see how senior civil servants and senior people in the MOD say, well, actually, we can't afford it. You know, there are so many big ticket things the government has said that it wants to spend the money on, but it just can't. You know, something's got to give. And of course, the new defence secretary is trying to get more money so he can have all these things, but the government isn't really being very amenable to that. The money just isn't there. So, we believe there are opportunities for the cancellation of Trident. We believe it's very important to keep on working for change in party policies on Trident replacement, particularly in the Labour Party. Although the current party policy, as I say, is pro-Trident, there has been a large influx of young people into the Labour Party who are overwhelmingly, as polls show, opposed to nuclear weapons, you know, very much seeing them as a kind of bizarre thing of the 20th century, you know, that's kind of old thinking. So CND is not alone in thinking that we should be getting rid of nuclear weapons. Just last year, in the United Nations General Assembly, they voted to agree a global nuclear ban treaty, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. That is now open for signature, and it is currently being signed up to by many countries around the world. Interestingly, over half the world is already organized, self-organized into nuclear weapons-free zones. There are countries that have had nuclear weapons that have given them up, and there are 9 countries that insist on retaining them. So it's a very much a minority sport to have nuclear weapons, and it is something that is very much deplored globally by the overwhelming majority of states. So the challenge for all of us, obviously, is not just to get rid of Britain's nuclear weapons, but to address the global problem of nuclear weapons. Because if we don't act and we don't work to bring the kind of the global desire for abolition of nuclear weapons, if we don't bring that into reality, then we can be sure that a nuclear war is going to take place sooner or later. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. They were lovely, those pictures, for taking us through that whole history of CND. I thought I'd start myself with a couple of questions. I mean, one question is, why on earth? I mean, it was a Labour government that approved the Trident replacement. Mm. And when you think that in the 1980s, Labour was anti-nuclear, and then there was that famous election when Neil Kinnock changed his position and looked like an opportunist and so lost it. Mm. Why was Labour, why has CND not managed to shift Labour? And following on that question, are we going to be able to debate it at the Labour Party conference this year?
good questions. Well, first of all, on the question of when Trident first came to Parliament in 2006, it was Blair, under Blair's government, they produced a white paper saying that they wanted to replace the nuclear weapon system. And I suppose we probably thought, well, that's typical Blair. He talks about being a war-fighting nation and all this kind of thing. But actually, when his autobiography came out some years later, he talked in quite a lot of detail about the decision about Trident replacement. And he said that he looked at both sides of the argument. He looked at for and against, and he thought there was a very good case either way. And you could, you know, you could... The case against nuclear weapons was a good case too, and he could have opted for either. In the end, he decided that we needed to replace Trident because, as he said, not to do so would be too great a downgrading of our status as a nation. Okay? So nothing about military stuff or safety or security or anything like that. In fact, he was well known as saying, you know, Trident doesn't meet any of our security needs whatsoever. No one thinks there's a nuclear threat against us. But it was all to do with Britain's status. You know, we had to have nuclear weapons to have a seat at the top table and punch above our weight and all these kinds of sort of jargons for, you know, we've got to be a heavy hitter kind of thing. And that's the reason. And I have repeatedly heard that from senior political figures, the former Tory chair of the Defence Select Committee, for example, he said exactly the same thing. He said the only argument in favour of it is the status argument. He said, and it's not a very good argument, you know. But so it's a lot of money to pay for something that actually the overwhelming majority of the world doesn't hold you in respect for having. So anyway, that's the kind of Blair thing. I mean, I think the other problem with the Labour Party on this, and this is my thinking after, you know, over a decade of having debates with people from different political parties and Labour MPs and Labour councillors and so on, they often say, well, actually, yeah, I think it's a bad idea, I think it's a complete waste of money, we shouldn't have them, but if we have a position against nuclear weapons, the Tories will attack us for being soft on defence, and therefore it would be a vote loser and they shouldn't do it.
So not even really that I think that people are actively convinced it's really necessary and it's a good thing for us. You know, it's more that if we don't have it, we'll look soft on defence. So, for example, well, quite a bit of the rhetoric from the shadow cabinet. So Emily Thornberry, for example, is the shadow foreign secretary at Labour Party last year. She said, under Labour, Britain will be a strong leader in NATO, you know. So, and the shadow defence secretary, Nia Griffith, is very, very pro-Trident, although actually, just a few years ago, she was very anti-Trident, and actually launched the Stop Trident campaign in Wales. She's a Welsh MP, so I don't know how she had that change of heart on that. But anyway, she's very pro-Trident, also very pro-NATO. When it was NATO's 60th birthday, she tweeted, "Happy birthday, NATO," and sort of talked about it as a kind of collective body for kind of progress and democracy kind of thing. So very weird, from our point of view, very weird ideas that need to be changed. But I truly believe that that is now a minority position in the Labour Party, and that if you did have a free vote, an opportunity to vote on it at Labour Party conference, I think it would probably go the other way. Every year, Labour CND, which is a specialist section, supports Labour CLPs to put in motions calling for a debate and so on Trident, and they are always ruled out of order. Even last year and the year before, they were ruled out of order. So we hope that it'll be possible for that issue to be openly debated in the Labour Party.
Yeah, I mean, that was the change in conference rules that New Labour brought in. Mm. Anyway, let me open it up. Yes.
Thank you very much. If I'm right, the biggest nuclear test so far was, if I'm right, in the sixth.
Can everyone hear? Because there are microphones. And it actually would be nice to know who you are.
I'm actually a graduate of the International Relations Department of this university. Robin Hannah, a graduate of the International Relations Department. If I'm right, am I right in saying that the biggest nuclear test so far was sometime in the early 60s, by the Soviet Union, when Nikola Khrushchev was the leader, a 50-megaton test, and that, I will understand that that's the biggest nuclear test that we've seen since nuclear. Am I right or not in this?
I couldn't swear to it, but you probably are, I'm sure.
I don't know either. Yes.
Hello, I'm Javan. It was a question in relation to the Labour Party as well. I'm one of the young members of the Labour Party, and you were saying that it seems like a minority position, that people are in support. I, from my experience, it seems to be the other way around. Doing a lot of stuff with like Labour students and Young Labour, some people still think that nuclear weapons are an ideal thing. I just don't know, are we loud singing and shouting minority, or do people actually think that? Because from my experience, it just seems like a bunch of young Labour members protesting. Of course, like, they're doing very good things, but I just wonder, like, how effective, because these are the people that are going to be running the Labour Party, surely, in the next few years. How can we twist that narrative from my generation? Having a good conversation, really, and convincing them that nuclear weapons are bad.
And can I just ask you a question? Do they think that nuclear weapons actually keep us safe?
I don't think so, but I think they adopt that kind of, we're soft on national defence. I think they make the Tory party.
Okay.
And they make it more of a quite political thing rather than a realistic situation. I find it very frustrating.
Like Brexit.
Yeah. Well, I think that is the danger. I mean, it a bit links to the arguments I was mentioning earlier, you know, people saying, well, we're not really that keen on it ourselves, we're not convinced that it's a good thing, or even we think it's a bad thing, but we'll go along with it, you know, because that's like the status quo argument, or it's more likely to win votes. I think for quite a long, for most of the post-war period, you know, with a couple of small exceptions, Labour was pro-nuclear, you know, in the same way that it was Labour that was responsible for setting up Britain's nuclear weapons programme. Labour was responsible for taking us into NATO and sort of co-founding NATO. You know, that is, you know, Labour has not been a kind of fantastic anti-nuclear, anti-imperialist, whatever organisation. You know, it's a sort of mainstream, quite establishment thing in many respects, particularly on foreign policy, I think. I think on kind of economic policy and thing prior to Blair, there were attempts to do something different and have a redistributive economic programme and so on. But it's never really challenged the kind of sense of Britain in the world or anything like that. And that's what Labour really needs to do. I think it needs to kind of rethink how it approaches the rest of the world. That is now present in the Labour Party manifesto, you know, about, you know, wanting to have a different relationship with the world, a different role in the world. But you can't have a different role in the world if you're still saying we've got to be a nuclear power with the capacity to kill millions of people and so on, you know, and want to have armies so we can intervene all over the place, you know. So it is a sort of dilemma for Labour, which way is it going to go? You know, I think the leader and much of the new influx want to go one way and sort of reshape Labour so it's not like a kind of wet Tory thing, you know, but there are still people in the establishment of Labour who want to carry on with essentially the Blairite project.
I think I might add something to that if it's okay with you. So yeah, I agree with you, and actually it's worth noting that the decision to acquire nuclear weapons was taken by a Labour government. It was taken by a small subcommittee of the cabinet, and initially there were only two people present: Attlee, who was the Prime Minister, and Stafford Cripps, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And Ernie Bevin, who was the Foreign Secretary, came in late, having come from a meeting with the US Secretary of State. And he said, "I've never been spoken to like that in my life. So we've got to get a nuclear weapon with a bloody Union Jack on top." So right from the beginning, it was a status argument. So that was one thing I wanted to say. But the other thing I really wanted to say is that I just find it extraordinary that nuclear weapons are an existential problem. That they're much too important to just depend on your calculations of whether or not you're going to win elections. It's absolutely crazy to me that that's the case. And, you know, what I find quite depressing is that one of the reasons so many people welcomed Corbyn was the feeling that for the first time he was saying what he really believed. And his discourse on austerity, anti-austerity, really did change views in this country. And I feel, actually, that if there were to be a Labour Party position against nuclear weapons in the 21st century, as Kate made it clear in her lecture, they are so anachronistic. We have so many problems that are really urgent for us to solve, from cybersecurity to climate change to dealing with conflicts in places like Syria and Libya. You know, that this continued attachment to nuclear weapons is completely crazy. What is more is that our argument for the Trident submarine is that they're undetectable. We have three and two are always going around underwater. Well, now with drones, it is actually possible to detect them. So, you know, the idea that we actually have an effective deterrent is completely mad. I mean, the whole thing, there is a sort of madness in it, and I think that people don't want to really think about. I mean, it is just really mad. When I watched that you were saying about you have to promise to press the button, and Theresa May said, "Yes, I will press the button," and I thought, well, at least, and Corbyn said, "I would be extremely cautious." And I thought, if you were really faced with that situation, wouldn't you be extremely cautious? If you weren't extremely cautious, either you're mad or else you're telling lies. I mean, and nobody picked that point up. It's just so mad that it's almost as though it's a kind of test that you have to take to be allowed to be part of the British establishment. You have to lie. You have to be ready to lie before you can be part of the British establishment.
I would like to know your views. One of the greatest crimes is the connivance by American, British, and France of stealing the material by Israel. If you look at the Vanunu affairs and all that, that is the most difficult, most, apart from any problems of Russia or America, the fact that Israel has this nuclear bombs and technology on a, such a massive scale. It was stolen surreptitiously, and it's connived by the American, British, and France as such. And the suggestion by the Middle East country to have a nuclear-free Middle East, I think that is the flashpoint in this world. Nothing else, I think it doesn't matter whether CND and other things. The fact is the Israel is a really a nefarious, a terrorist state, you see, preventing. And it is a cancer in the Middle East. And unless something is done, this is bound to a flashpoint in the. And then we have got now Trump, a madman, you see, at the table, presiding, you see. So I would like your views on that, whether it is possible, apart from the Israel is a terrorist state and it will never be able to have peace in the Middle East.
Yes, I mean, we've been campaigning against Israeli nuclear weapons in the same way that we campaign against all nuclear weapons and call for full, you know, global nuclear disarmament. And of course, we were very active in the campaign to free Mordecai Vanunu. You know, in fact, CND's office is called Mordecai Vanunu House because, you know, what he did as a whistleblower and then spending so many years in solitary confinement was just absolutely extraordinary. And of course, as you know, at the United Nations for many, many years, there have been these motions passed repeatedly that for a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East. At the last NPT review conference, there were repeated initiatives taken. And in fact, there were, I think it was Norway, one of the Scandinavian countries, that led a series of meetings to try and bring all parties to the table, including Israel. But of course, unfortunately, Israel, although it did engage in dialogue a little bit at the beginning, it then refused to participate in any kind of substantive discussion or conferences around it. So they are...
United States protecting, you see, all the things activities.
Well, I think Britain was also involved in Israel having getting the technology and the heavy water and so on through which to develop nuclear weapons. And of course, if the United States wanted to, it could bring about a very rapid change in the situation.
Yeah.
But it doesn't want to because, you know, Israel is its number one ally in the Middle East.
Mm.
So all the focus in terms of nuclear weapons in the Middle East is on Iran, which doesn't have a nuclear weapons program. You know, so obviously there is widespread concern about a kind of double standards issue going on. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Vicky, and I was born in Los Alamos, where my parents were atomic weapons workers. And I really appreciate all your efforts. Thank you for all these decades of your work. In the United States, I think that working on nuclear weapons went from being very prestigious, not just working, but maintaining them, to kind of a backwater position. We see the United States Air Force, many mistakes, whole squadrons decommissioned because they didn't satisfy certain standards for handling nuclear weapons. Some scientists no longer feel that that's a prestige position. And through the decades, through whistleblowers like Eric Schlosser's book, Command and Control, many more of the maintenance mistakes, the safety mistakes, have have come out because scientists have been willing to speak, finally. And I just wonder, in Britain, what are the penalties for whistleblowers, for scientists to come forward to say these nuclear weapons are not being properly maintained? They're, in many cases, a maintenance hazard today. And not necessarily because they're obsolete, but just the personnel is not so interested. So I think in the United States it's had a bit of an impact. We see all the news where our nuclear weapons of all kinds are being mishandled and not well maintained. What happens here in Britain to a whistleblower, a scientist, a military person who comes forward and says we have a big safety risk?
Well, Mary may know others, but there was recently, within the last 2 years, there was a young man who, in the forces, you know, who was on, I think he was on a nuclear weapons submarine that had berthed in Scotland. I just can't remember his name. can't remember exactly who he went to first, but anyway, it became a big public issue because he was saying about all kinds of security lapses on the submarines and that people weren't being checked when they came on and off and, you know, use of social media and new technology and all that kind of thing, which, of course, is detrimental to the kind of security of the systems on board and all kinds of things. But basically, things were at risk because proper procedures weren't being followed and there was a kind of completely cavalier approach to it. And he was a serving soldier, mariner, submariner, I suppose, and he came under massive, massive pressure, and it was, you know, suggested that he had mental health problems and all this kind of thing, and then his family came under pressure, and then after a while it was said that he was sort of gone off on sick leave or something and was being supported by his regiment and all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, who knows exactly what the situation was. And then lots of military people stepped forward and said, no, there's no kinds of problems with any of this stuff. It's all fine. This is, you know, he's sort of, you know, fantasizing or something. So the way they dealt with him was by bringing the mental health issue into it rather than saying he's a kind of nasty pacifist saboteur or something like that. It was done in a kind of care and concern for him kind of way.
Who are you talking about again?
I just can't remember his name. Yes, it was a relatively young submariner. I think it was called William something or other. But can you think of any other?
I can't remember. I can't think of any other, although Patricia Lewis, who is at Chatham House, she produces report after report on the history of accidents and the problems of safety that I find very compelling.
In fact, one of the safety areas which has come up recently, in particular because of the different type of government in Scotland, you know, where the government is anti-nuclear, and although it it's not within its powers to get rid of the nuclear weapons from Scotland, it does have sort of the right to raise other issues. And one of the big health and safety concerns is the transportation of nuclear warheads on the road from Aldermaston in Berkshire up the M6 and through all kinds of towns and cities and all that sort of thing up to Coolport near Faslane in Scotland. And there are regular monitoring, you know, from Nuke Watch members, you know, activists monitoring these things. And quite often there are reports of accidents, you know, things getting lost, you know, all kinds of... I mean, I think it's an absolute miracle that there hasn't been a major accident, you know. I mean, in the past there have been accidents that have been covered up, but I think it's, I mean, not around that particularly, you know, but, you know, through planes and all kinds of stuff. But it's quite extraordinary that a massive catastrophe hasn't actually happened.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I'm Pierce Wilkinson from the United States, where I teach political science. And one of the reasons I'm here is because the title included Campaigning in the Age of Trump. two of the most notable people involved with nuclear weapons is the leader of North Korea and the leader of the United States, neither of which seem very inclined to be rational and to be interested in worldwide nuclear ban. As a matter of fact, they mostly talk about the sizes of their thumbs and the buttons that they have, which will bring them to the table in a week or two. What impact do you think your movement has had on other countries, or particularly on world perspectives at the moment between the United States and North Korea and Iran and others? You've been mostly looking at it from a domestic perspective, and I'm interested in the international one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we are a UK organization, but we do work closely with other organizations internationally, whether it's in the US or France or Germany or Japan or wherever. And we're also part of the new international organization, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, which recently won the Nobel Peace Prize for its work in support of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. So we do very much attempt to take an international perspective. But obviously, because Britain has nuclear weapons itself, we do tend to very much be focused on that. But in terms of what the movement as a whole has achieved, there are some very specific examples, like contributing to the pressure which led to the partial test ban treaty, for example. So I think a lot of it is not easily quantifiable, but one is aware that it has helped create a climate where certain changes come about. So, for example, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty in the late 1980s, which ended cruise missiles and that whole class of nuclear weapons. It's my belief that the kind of pressure in Britain, but also across Europe and elsewhere, led to the achievement of that treaty. Another one is the campaign against the neutron bomb, which in fact isn't very widely known about, but in the 1970s, there was an attempt to install the neutron bomb in Europe as well. The neutron bomb was a bomb which didn't destroy buildings and property and so on. It was a kind of radiological bomb which killed people. And there was such an outcry and a huge campaign against that, that it was actually withdrawn and never brought to Britain or Europe. So there are quite a few examples of those things. And I think one of the other things is the fact that nuclear weapons have never been used in wars again since 1945. And as I understand it, many US presidents, amongst others no doubt, have wanted to use nuclear weapons or proposed the use of them, like Nixon in Vietnam, but have been prevented or held back from doing so, not very much because of the impact that it had have on public opinion. You know, that was his advisors. Nixon's advisors said you can't do that because of public opinion, because of the freeze movement and SANE and so on in the United States that were campaigning against it. I mean, in terms of CND's kind of role in that, on our 50th birthday 10 years ago, there was quite a lot of media coverage and so on. And there was an article written in, I think it was The Times, by someone called Matthew Paris, who's now a kind of great commentator, who'd been a Tory, a conservative MP during the 1980s, and he was sort of would very often debate with CND from the other side, you know, from the pro-nuclear side, and he was asked to comment on 50 years of CND, and he said, well, you know, although I haven't always agreed with them, I think they have done something that's very good, which is to make the idea of nuclear weapons use something that is a tragedy, you know, that is too terrible to conceive of, and everyone talks about use of nuclear weapons as though it would be a catastrophe. And that's helped to, you know, kind of sustain or kind of build and develop the narrative that they shouldn't be used. You know, virtually every country or every government has always said, yeah, of course we've got to get rid of nuclear weapons, you know, because everyone accepts that they are a terrible thing. You know, getting to that stage where then they actually are got rid of is the next stage, you know, which we're still engaged in. But I think if it wasn't for the movements, I think that there wouldn't have been the progress that there has been, and potentially there could have been nuclear use.
Does anyone else want to say anything? I very much agree with what Kate just said, but I think what does disturb me is that there's something about the way anti-nuclear activism comes in waves. And in between, people just don't want to think about it. It's so horrible, they don't want to talk about it. And I wish this room had been packed. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that we're going through a period where people just don't want to think about it. And how we, you know, there's suddenly moments like in the 80s, like in the 60s, when suddenly people think we have to do something about it. And how do we create those moments? Because I do think this is, you know, your question about Trump. I was in Washington, D.C. recently, and I found a former student of mine, embarrassingly, in the National Security, what's it called, the National Security Office. And he was partly involved in drafting the Nuclear Posture Review. And so I asked him what he was doing, and he said, well, there's a real dangerous gap in the escalation ladder. And I thought, oh, this takes me back to the 1980s. I thought we'd killed those arguments. You know, this was the argument about how to make the use of nuclear weapons credible. You have to have usable nuclear weapons because otherwise nobody's going to believe that you're going to use them. And you have to do it in Europe because otherwise nobody's going to believe. You don't want to threaten, you know. So all those old arguments are resurfacing in the Trump administration. And, you know, it's just so depressing that every generation has to go through this whole process over and over again, and we desperately need to be doing it. Let's hope that Trump is vain enough to want to have a big achievement with North Korea, and the same with Kim Jong-un, or however you pronounce his name. You know, that would be great, but... I just do think there's such a need, and there's such a need to situate it in a sort of global context. I think this point that you made about Israel, I mean, what really disturbs me is the way that Israel has managed to become a master at the new, what the Russians call political technology, so that I'm not sure whether it's the US controlling Israel or Israel controlling the US. And that's a whole issue that we have to, I think, start addressing. But anyway, thank you very much for, even if we were small, we were a quality audience. So thank you very much for coming, and I hope you